March 12, 1938. June 10, 1938, the United States becomes a member of Interpol. As soon as Hitler annexes Austria, he fires and imprisons the head of the Austrian Federal Police, Stubel, replaces him with a previously imprisoned Nazi named Otto Steinhausel, who then assumes, because he becomes head of the Austrian Federal Police, and recall that by prior agreement among the members of Interpol, due to an internal dispute, the head of the Austrian Federal Police was president of Interpol. Otto Steinhausel, the Nazi, was president of Interpol at the moment at which J. Edgar Hoover's FBI became a member of Interpol. Now, this is taking place in 1938, which is also the very same year in which Whitaker Chambers is first powwowing with Undersecretary of State Adolph Burley Jr., and also in which the FBI, the same FBI headed up by J. Edgar Hoover, is beginning its investigation of Alger Hiss. So, March of 38, Hitler annexes Austria, makes the president of Interpol Nazi Otto Steinhausel. June of 38, Interpol, the United States, and J. Edgar Hoover's FBI joins Interpol. And it's worth noting, as we're going to see a little later, talking about the history of Interpol, that Steinhausel, who was in poor health from his internment before Austria became Nazi, Steinhausel died about a year after assuming the head of the Austrian Federal Police and the presidentship of the presidency of Interpol. He was replaced by none other than Reinhard Heydrich, the head of the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS intelligence service, and again, known appropriately enough as the Hangman.
Okay, this is from a book entitled The Interpol Connection. It's written by Vaughn Young and Trevor Meldal Johnson. That last name is Meldal-Johnson. It's copyright 1979 by the Dial Press. It says as follows, in spite of Hoover's activities, this of course is J. Edgar Hoover, in spite of Hoover's activities against pro-Nazi sympathizers at home, documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act reveal that the FBI actively cooperated with the Nazi Interpol for a year and a half after Europe had fallen to Hitler, and that Hoover consistently maintained the fiction that the ICPC was an, quote, independent organization. On March 28, 1939, the State Department telephoned the FBI to ask if Germany had taken over control of Interpol, quote, or whether the FBI had any information along that line, whatever. Hoover replied that, quote, the meeting in Berlin is merely being held in Germany this year. The organization is an independent entity which holds its meetings in different countries at different times, unquote. We'll get back to that. Of course, this was after Germany had taken over Austria and Interpol, imprisoning some of its officials and installing its own puppet Steinhausel as president, after releasing him from jail in Vienna. During this time, Hoover's relations with Interpol officials were extremely cordial. For example, W. Fleischer, a Third Reich criminal police commissioner and a Hoover admirer, wrote to the FBI chief on June 26, 1939, thanking him for the FBI's annual report and proudly informing Hoover that the Reich's fingerprint division had 772,371 fingerprint records. He enclosed a photograph of Berlin's new police laboratory and concluded by saying, quote, may I ask you a personal favor? I should be deeply grateful to you if you could send me a photograph of yourself with a little dedication. Hoover sent him an autographed photograph. This was after the fall of Czechoslovakia. Let me go back and touch on one thing real quickly. That is, again, now, the State Department, which at this time was the Roosevelt government State Department, the New Deal Roosevelt government, hated by the right wing in this country.
Of which Alger Hiss was a member.
Of which Alger Hiss was a member, and to become a leading proponent of decontaminating American business and their connections with the Nazis later on. The Roosevelt State Department contacted the FBI, asked them if Interpol had been taken over by the Nazis, which in fact it obviously had, and Hoover told them no, and in fact flat out lied to them, and at the same time was carrying on friendly correspondence and sending autographed pictures to young Nazi police commissioners.
Okay.
I got another section here. Yes, I know. Okay, and we're going to talk about this in a moment. Now, bear in mind, once again, now what we're talking about here is not necessarily a connection of you know, this to this to this is, you know, circumstantial. What we're talking about is our trends. We're talking about trends within the American business establishment before, during, and after the war to at all times, and of course right-wing elements of the government to at all times make common causes with fascism rather than with democratic forces within their own country. We're talking about a consistent policy, and there's no other way to put it than that. A consistent policy of American interests before, during, and after World War II, making common cause with the fascists, not only against communism, but in fact against democracy. And in the very last part of this show, when we talk about McCarthy, we're going to give you one of the most flagrant examples of that that I have personally ever seen.
Keep in mind the timetable now, too. 1934, 1935, Alger Hiss is working for the Nye Committee, exposing the industrial connections between the U.S. and Nazi Germany. And this was in the relatively early stages of those connections, okay? 1938, Whitaker Chambers, apparently, at least for a while, a Russian spy, although perhaps he was a double agent. He keeps the life-size portrait, almost life-size portrait of Hitler over his fireplace, believed by some to be a German spy, meets with Adolf Berle to first place the accusations against Hiss before World War II. FBI begins investigating him at that same point. FBI joins the Nazi-dominated Interpol at that point. Chambers is deep-sixing news about the partisans' democratic governments being set up after having worked against Hitler in 1944, and then Hiss becomes president of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace.
Okay, now you heard in the last section that I just read about Hoover after the fall of Czechoslovakia corresponding warmly with police officials of Nazi-dominated Interpol. Going ahead a few years here, by September 16, 1940, it says in the Interpol connection, a month after Germany began to bomb London, Hoover was still friendly with Nazi Interpol officials. After receiving materials on passport standardization from Interpol in Berlin, Hoover politely acknowledged their receipt and, as a routine matter, with no mention that anything was out of the ordinary, forwarded a copy of the passport data to Adolf A. Berle Jr., Assistant Secretary of State. I hope you remember that name. Furthermore, FBI wanted notices appeared in the ICPC journal until near the end of 1940. Now catch this. That year, four of the wanted notices described the criminals in a uniquely un-American way, Jewish race. In 1940, the head of the German security police, Reinhard Heydrich, later known as the Hangman, consolidated his position by becoming president of Interpol. Steinhausel, whom the Germans had placed as head of Interpol after the Anschluss, had died from tuberculosis a year after taking over as head of Interpol. And Heydrich announced that, quote, since the adoption of a resolution in 1934, the head of the Vienna police has been the president of ICPC. Austria is now an integral part of Germany, and the resolution concerned should therefore apply to the director of the Sicherheitspolizei of the Third Reich. According to the ICPC magazine, the resolution was unanimously accepted, as was a vote to move the commission's headquarters to Berlin. However, it appears that the vote was conducted by mail, and those who did not reply were considered in favor of the proposal. On April 15, 1941, the organization and all of its permanent administrative machinery was moved to the Berlin suburb of Wannsee.
Okay.
W-A-N-N-S-E-E.
Remember that name. Now, of course, Wannsee was the same Berlin suburb where the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the RSHA, the top Reich Security Bureau, was located. Okay, now the Wannsee Institute, which was an espionage organization against Russia set up by the Sicherheitsdienst, headed at this time, of course, by Reinhard Heydrich. The Wannsee Institute was headed by Michael Achmetelli and included Emil Augsburg. It was not only used for espionage against Russia, but it was very much involved, as we've seen, with Hitler's final solution, his extermination of the Jews. Okay, now Interpol was actually part of the Reichssicherheitshauptamt. Continuing now with the Interpol connection by Vaughn Young and Trevor Meldal Johnson. Organizationally, Interpol was located in the RSHA, the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the National Department of Security. the combined national headquarters of the SD and the SIPO, the new branch of the German police that linked the Gestapo, the secret state police, and the Kripo, the criminal police. So recouping that now, the RSHA consists of the SD, which is the SS Intelligence Service, the Sicherheitsdienst, and the SIPO, S-I-P-O. The SIPO consists of the Kripo, K-R-I-P-O, which is a nickname for Kriminalpolizei, and the Gestapo, which is a contraction of Geheimestaatspolizei, or Secret State Police, okay? So Interpol is actually part of the very same RSHA in the very same Wannsee that the Wannsee Institute was located. And as we've seen, two of its top officials, its head, and one of its top, basically sort of racial classification chief, went on to work as part of the triumvirate that formed the special forces for Galen. Continuing here with the Interpol connection. On October 4th, 1944, G2 report, G2 being American Military Intelligence, on October 4th, 1944, G2 report discusses the Kripo as, quote, an integral part of the Nazi machine of repression, and as such makes fullest use of the racial laws of the Third Reich. Recall that those racial laws were drawn up by Hans Globke, Adenauer's Secretary of State. Continuing, the arrest of deserters and escaped prisoners of war should be noted among the Kripo's duties, unquote. The SD was the intelligence system of the SS and Nazi Party. The RSHA consisted of 8 Amtsstellen, or bureaus, but it was regarded as a single department rather than a collection of separate offices. The 3 branches, Gestapo, Kripo, SD, were closely connected. Interpol's section was Amt 5, or Bureau 5, also known as the RKPA, the Reichskriminalpolizeiamt, the Office of State Criminal Police. Recall that Franz Alfred Sieks of the Green Berets, of the Special Forces, was head of Amt 7, or Bureau 7. Continuing now with some information here about Interpol and about the RSHA, and some unnerving information about the FBI. Again, this is from the Interpol connection by Vaughn Young and Trevor Melville Johnson. An undated Allied Control Authority memorandum relating to an inspection of the ICPC files discovered in Berlin in 1945 or early 1946 said that, quote, despite its close connection with the Reichskriminalpolizeiamt, the ICPC apparently tried to maintain international contacts and implications to the end. In 1942, the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation was still carried in a report as a cooperating agency, unquote. There were no further details. And now Young and Melville Johnson go on to describe some other things concerning Interpol, again, part of the RSHA, specifically part of the Reichskriminalpolizeiamt in 1942. Keep in mind that the FBI, then headed by J. Edgar Hoover, was listed in the files as a cooperating agency.
1 year after the United States and Germany had gone into declared war with each other.
On January 20th, 1942, the now infamous Wannsee Conference was held. There, 16 top Nazis, including Adolf Eichmann, were called together by Heydrich to lay out the, quote, final solution to the Jewish problem, unquote. Although the conference has been the subject of nearly every history of the era, only one writer noted that the final solution was planned in ICPC offices. So the Interpol offices were the site for the planning of the extermination of European Jewry. And that took place, that conference, in the aforementioned Wannsee suburb on 1-20-42. And after that, Hoover's FBI is listed as a cooperating agency, unquote. Worth noting, too, while noting J. Edgar Hoover's fascist sympathies, that there's a book which is currently available, which we really don't have time to go into the material here, called Spy Counter Spy by a former British intelligence agent named Dusko Popov, last name P-O-P-O-V. Popov learned of Japan's, he was an agent in Europe, but learned of Japan's plans to attack Pearl Harbor, relayed them to the United States, and according to Popov, it was J. Edgar Hoover, not Franklin Roosevelt, but J. Edgar Hoover, who prevented the information that Popov relayed to him from being presented to Franklin Roosevelt. So that, again, that book is available. It's all around, both in paperback and hardcover. So look around and you'll be able to find it. Now, it's worth noting also that Interpol J. Edgar Hoover, after the war, became vice president of Interpol, and not only many Vichy French, many French fascists continued to work for the organization, but its Nazi connections remained apparently very intact and operative. As late as 1972, the Interpol president was a man named Paul Dickopf, D-I-C-K-O-P-F, who was head of the BKA, the Bundeskriminalamt, which was the West German Federal Police, again, the supposedly denazified West Germany. And Paul Dickopf was not only a former Sicherheitsdienst man, a former SD man, but was also an agent of the Gehlen organization, both when it was part of the CIA and when it went to be the West German Intelligence Service. So these connections were still very, very operative for quite some time after World War II. Now, keep in mind that, again, Hoover was very active against Alger Hiss, along with Adolf Berle, and as we've seen, Adolf Berle and J. Edgar Hoover had no hesitation whatsoever about passport standardization with the Nazified Interpol in 1940, after Nazi Germany was bombing London, when Reinhard Heydrich was president of the organization, and the names, of course, these are the names that crop up in connection with Alger Hiss. Adolf Berle is going to crop up again in just a second. Now, go ahead, Nip.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, now, before we take our break, we have a little bit more information that we want to relay to you, but we're sort of turning a corner here, so I'm going to make a sort of a brief policy statement here as to the change in the focus of the information now. Now, in a larger sense, what we're looking at, again, and admittedly, we're focusing on a very small area, namely, I guess you could say, the importation of Nazi ideology into the United States security organizations of various sorts. But this is because this is something that we can focus on that people almost never hear about. And this is probably the key thing that comes out of this entire broadcast, is to realize, when you look back on the other things that happened during the Cold War, our precipitation into the war in Vietnam, our continuing Cold War with Russia, our activities in Europe and various other things all over the rest of the world, the beginning, the formulation of the sort of perverted version of the Monroe Doctrine that has been levied on South and Central America, going clean back into the late 1940s and early 1950s. When you're looking at these things, I think a direct implication that has to be at least considered is this massive importation, essentially, of Nazi ideology into the security apparatus of our countries, at which point it then became official policy, and then the policy was explained to us in light of anti-communism and the need for national security. And of course, this is exactly how it was levied onto Nazi Germany, and during the rise of Nazism, was the danger of Bolshevism and the need for national security. The individual American may not have been guilty of an overwhelming hatred of communism. He had to be taught to hate communism because, in fact, this was the governing ideology of the security apparatus of the country.
In fact, I think a better word rather than importation, although certainly much of what has now been incorporated into our national security establishment was imported, I think incorporation might be a better word, for the simple reason that, Nazism, the Third Reich, was not the sort of isolated phenomena that it's generally represented in conventional history. As we've seen, the Nazis, who all along planned to conquer the world, were anti-communist, and their anti-communism was a major point in winning favor with a great many elements all around the world. Many key industrialists favored them, and as we highlight these Nazi connections here for you, the point is that the Third Reich was, sometimes the symbolism, the swastikas, the goose-stepping, the torchlight parades, the monster rallies, and so forth, the Sieg Heiling, it serves to remove it from our normal experience. It's rendered as something, somehow separate. There's this crazy man, Hitler, hypnotized everybody and made them all go crazy, and then when he died, that was it. As Gustav Stolper said, denazification was achieved when Hitler committed suicide. The point is that the anti-communist aspect of the Third Reich had tremendous sympathy. It won the Third Reich tremendous sympathy all over the industrialized world, because many key industrialists saw that Nazism or fascism as the antidote to socialism or communism, whatever word you want to use, and that, in fact, these Nazi connections is to highlight the fact that it was not an isolated phenomenon, but rather the Third Reich was part of a series of events, a series of political reaction, of political reactionary events, which stretches in an unbroken line from 1917 to the present.
Okay, so whether or not you use the term incorporation, or which I agree, I think that is probably a better term, incorporation, what we're looking at next, what the next section of the broadcast is going to deal with, is in fact the coming into prominence in American life, not only of the ideology of National Socialist Germany, but in fact of many of the personages of National Socialist Germany. And we're going to once again check up on the career of Richard Nixon, who certainly always seems to be around the waterhole when the Nazis come down to drink. And we've got a couple of other things and some rather revealing things that I had never myself seen before until just recently, and I'm sure a lot of you haven't seen either, on Joseph McCarthy that will curdle your blood.
Right, and again, keep in mind the elements that were active against Hiss. Chambers, we've seen his fascist sympathies. J. Edgar Hoover, we've seen his overtly fascist sympathies. And Richard Nixon, the man who defeated Jerry Voorhees, well, stay tuned for his fascist sympathies.
And we'll be back in just a moment with the last hour of Looking Back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, on Radio Free America on KFJC 89.7 in Los Altos Hills. You're listening to Radio Free America, a presentation of the Public Affairs Department of radio station KFJC. All right. This is Nip Tuck back with you for the final hour with Dave Emery here live in the studios at KFJC. And we are going into the final hour, as I said, of Looking Back from 1984, A Hidden History of the Cold War. In fact, this is the eighth hour overall of this broadcast since we did 4 hours last month, and we're doing our fourth hour tonight. And as we mentioned at the break, we're going to be talking now about some of the direct importation not only of Nazism but Nazis into America, and we're going to see the resurfacing once again of that omnipresent character in American politics.
Our elder statesman.
Our elder statesman. When the Nazis come to call, Dick is always at home, and we're going to see what part he plays in some of this stuff coming up. Now, first off, a very necessary thing to understand that Dave is going to explain is about the fact of Nazism and the fact that not all of the people who were Nazis were in fact Germans, but that there were several native groups of fascists all over Eastern Europe in particular, as well as groups like the Vichy French and other occupation groups in Western Europe who embraced the Nazis with open arms and, in fact, in many cases even outdid the Nazis in the kind of horrors that the Nazis are most famous for. And I would reiterate again a point I made at the beginning of the show. Some of the stuff coming up in this section is rather graphic. If you have a small child, some of it is rather unpleasant.
Right. Okay, now, as we've indicated, fascism was a very, very popular movement throughout the world, of course, particularly in Europe, but many people saw many different things in it. Some saw it as anti-communist, and it certainly was anti-communist. It was also much more than that. As we indicated, the Nazis themselves were able to parlay their anti-communism into an extremely effective tool for world conquest by infiltrating many places and organizations that they might not otherwise have been able to get access to. Now, there were many other fascist movements throughout Europe which were very closely allied politically, ideologically, and militarily with German National Socialism, with German Nazism. Now, first of all, it should be understood that the Axis was not just Germany, Japan, and Italy, but there were a number of other countries that were actually fighting on the Axis side during World War II, most of them in Eastern Europe. Those countries were Bulgaria, Hungary, Finland, and Romania. Those four countries also were part of the Axis, and this isn't something most people realize, but Finland, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Romania also fought on the side of the Axis during World War II. Now, the Romanian fascist movement was something called the Iron Guard, or the evangelical movement, the movement of the Archangel Michael, okay, of the Order of the Archangel Michael. Now, basically, they're almost always known as the Iron Guard. Their technical name had to do with the Archangel Michael. Now, the Iron Guard were, just like the other European fascist movements, extremely anti-Semitic, and they were very, very bloody. Their atrocities against the Jews were kind of like the Ustashi, the Croatian fascist movement, which set up an independent state in Croatia, one of the Slavic states, which was incorporated and is part of Yugoslavia. They would not just kill people, but they did so in a particularly grisly fashion. They were very, very atavistic. There was a blood drinking ritual which was part of the initiation into the Iron Guard, in which each member not only drank some of the other's blood but also let an ounce of his own blood into a cup which was then passed around as a sacrament. Now, the leader of the youth wing of the Iron Guard was a man named Viorel Trifa, V-I-O-R-E-L Trifa, T-R-I-F-A. Trifa was head of something called the Green Shirts, which were the youth wing of the Iron Guard, basically just like the Hitler Youth. Now, Viorel Trifa, one of the incidents in history that he is best known for is a vicious pogrom that he set up in 1941, I believe it was, that signaled the start of the Iron Guard revolt. And basically, he kicked off an attempted revolt to overthrow the government of Romania. Now, keep in mind, this is the Romanian fascist movement we're talking about, and he gave a fiery speech which resulted in a bloody pogrom, a slaughter of thousands of Romanian Jews, and it's worth noting that under the Iron Guard's and Third Reich's activities, under the Final Solution, only 300,000 of Romania's 800,000 Jews eventually survived. It was the third largest Jewish community in Romania. They were mostly exterminated, and the Iron Guard revolt, which was to culminate in the ascension of the Iron Guard to power, was kicked off by this pogrom, by a mass slaughtering of Jews, and that was triggered by a fiery speech given by Viorel Trifa.
Now, bear in mind one other thing here, which is that this is not merely for the sake of pointing out the savageries of war, but Viorel Trifa is going to play a key part in the United States in just a matter of moments as we move along. Now, this book that we're reading from is Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America, written by Howard Blum, B-L-U-M, copyright 1967, Quadrangle Books. And he's speaking about that selfsame speech that started the Iron Guard revolt and pogrom. From the statue of King Michael, Viorel Trifa delivered the speech which he and Sima had hoped would initiate a new revolt. Trifa, according to eyewitnesses, began cautiously, talking in a steady, calm voice. Below him, the square was packed with 6,000 listeners, and the crowd continued to increase. This war started, Trifa began, with the French Revolution. The origin of the old world was these miraculous words, liberty, equality, and fraternity. These words liberated the people from one tyrant who had enslaved them and, instead, delivered them to hundreds of thousands of tyrants exploiting these principles. People were never equal, not even in the first days of the revolution. These ideas of equality served a category of people who enslaved others and profited by these confused ideas. These ideas, Viorel Trifa said, these ideas of equality served the caiques. The caiques of Europe have intensified their struggle for emancipation at the moment when the revolutionary spirit reached the Rhine. The leadership of the people has fallen into the hands of a group of caiques and Jew lovers who are ruling everything, especially history. The League of Nations has served the interests of Jewry to dominate the world. London has become the center of world capitalism. On the shores of the fabulous Albion, Jewry has found a good place from where it will spread its spider web over the entire world. Trifa's voice now rising, the crowd intermittently shouting and applauding ferociously, he concluded his hour-long speech in a hoarse scream. Even if Adolf Hitler had done nothing else than wage this huge struggle of National Socialism which leads to the unmasking of the fight against Judaism, he would still have risen to great peaks of history as he blazed a new path. All right, the book goes on to describe how this group of people, thousands and thousands of people, whipped up into a fever pitch, stormed into the Jewish quarter of Bucharest and basically burned it down, killed thousands of people. Going on in the book, summing up, Howard Blum says, during the three-day Iron Guard revolt, the Romanian press reported that 118 Jews were killed and 26 were wounded. That's what the Romanian press said. The true death toll, as estimated by Jewish sources, was between 4,000 and 6,000 in Bucharest, and nearly 10,000 throughout the country. That's in 3 days. As Dave mentioned, the figure by the end of the Iron Guard period in Romania was somewhere approximately 500,000 Jews killed, but that's perhaps 10,000 killed in 3 days during the Iron Guard revolt. Okay, moving along, in Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America, it says, and this is a report from the president. This is, Dave, maybe you better fill this in on where this comes, this...
All right. Now, well, basically, what this is a report from, I believe it was the Romanian, an organization of Romanian Jews that was in the United States. Specifically, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency was the actual source for this information. Now, this comes in the context of a meeting of these Romanian Jews, which was attended by a man named Dr. Kramer, last name K-R-E-M-E-R. Now, Dr. Kramer was Romanian Jew who immigrated to the United States, and although his family survived the Iron Guard horrors, he was very, very active. He lost many of his relatives in the Iron Guard atrocities and in the Nazi atrocities because eventually they hooked up with the Third Reich, both military and politically, and eventually many German troops were in Romania. And Dr. Kramer was very active against VRL Trefa, both during the war when he was attempting to do what he could to sort of ease the situation of Romanian Jewry, and after the war when he pursued VRL Trefa.
Okay, so again, this is the president of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, the president reading the report of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, and it says, "On Wednesday afternoon," the president continued reading, "the Gardist General Staff ordered the destruction of the Bucharest Jewish Quarter and the murder of its inhabitants. Storming through the Jewish Quarter in a mad orgy of killing and destruction, armed Gardist gangs," that's Iron Guard, "killed or beat up every person they saw who appeared to be Jewish. The test seems to have been whether persons encountered by the frenzied Gardist gangs were willing to participate in the massacre. The pogrom, which cost the lives of at least 1,000 Jews in Bucharest, was not accidental, but an integral part of the Gardist insurrection and had been prepared in advance. Perhaps the most horrifying single episode of the pogrom was the, quote, kosher butchering last Wednesday night of more than 200 Jews in the municipal slaughterhouse. The Jews, who had been rounded up after several hours of Iron Guard raids, were put into several trucks and carried off to the slaughterhouse. There, the Green Shirts, that's a faction of the Iron Guard, forced them to undress and led them to the chopping blocks, where they cut their throats in a horrible parody of the traditional Jewish methods of slaughtering fowl and livestock. Some mangled bodies were disposed of by pouring them down manholes to the sewers usually used to carry animal remains. Other naked, headless bodies were hung on iron hooks and stamped Karne Kosher, kosher meat." The organization president had to stop. He needed to compose himself before continuing. "The general staff," he finally resumed, "which ordered the massacre consisted of Vice President Hori Asima, Chief of the Green Shirt Legion, Dmitry Groza, boss of the Legionary Workers Corps, and VRL Trefa, leader of the frenetic Green Shirt student movement."
Okay, now, eventually, after, well, we're going to talk a little bit about, in just a second, about what VRL Trefa did in the tail end of World War II. That's going to come as part of an exposition of just what his activities were in the United States, because after World War II, VRL Trefa obtained entry into the United States. Now, the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate had been very closely affiliated with the Romanian Orthodox Church. Now, as the Cold War really got underway, and as, of course, Romania was occupied by the Soviet Union as the Axis forces were driven back, and a communist government was set up in Romania. Now, as Cold War feelings heightened in the United States, the fact that the bishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate had been appointed by the head of the Romanian Orthodox Church in Romania, which at that time was governed by communism, although they had no perceptible effect on the church itself, aroused a great deal of bitterness and suspicion on the part of a great many people, a great many Romanian emigres in the United States, as well as by the federal authorities themselves. Now, in a really a violent takeover, the Iron Guardists, many of whom came into the United States at the end of World War II under, for a variety of different reasons, seized control of the Grass Lakes, Michigan seat of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. And they did so. They kicked out a fellow by the name of Moldovan, M-O-L-D-O-V-A-N, who was the bishop appointed by the head of the Romanian Orthodox Church. And they basically broke the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate off from the Romanian Orthodox Church. And the man who became head of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate was none other than VRL Trefa, but he changed his name to Valerian Trefa in order to sort of maintain his religious front, I guess you might say. So when you hear the name Valerian Trefa in the passage I'm just about to read to you, keep in mind that's the same fellow as VRL Trefa, the fellow who gave that blood-curdling speech which kicked off the horrible pogrom and, you know, the slaughtered corpses and so forth, which Nip just read you. Returning again to Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America by Howard Bloom. While Kramer traveled through Romania and then Israel in a small car he had bought in England, Valerian Trifa solidified his power as bishop. He now controlled an episcopate with 46 churches, mostly in Ohio, and 10,000 parishioners. The Vatra, that is the seat of the Romanian-American Orthodox Episcopate, the Vatra, which his supporters had taken by force, was now officially his. Bishop Moldovan's legal challenges were defeated. An Ohio district court, reaching its decision in the midst of the McCarthy era, decided, quote, "The communistic government of Romania was dictating appointment of its bishop, Moldovan, and the American diocese was entitled to revoke its 1936 bylaws and elect its own bishop, Trifa."
Let me just mention, too, in opposition to this, that what's going on, of course, we don't really have time to read the whole passage to you. When they say that it was taken over by force, that is literally true. VRL Trifa and essentially a gang of ex-Green Shirt and Iron Guard as stormtroopers literally came to the Vatra, the Romanian Orthodox Church, the center, and literally dragged the priests out, beat them up, broke legs and arms, and literally took the place by force. Now, bear this in mind, because this was later received official sanction in the United States as a way to transfer power of a bishop, because supposedly the other bishop was appointed by a communist church. Bear this in mind, especially because, as we mentioned earlier, parallels to Central and South America, that currently people like Archbishop Oscar Romero have been shot dead in El Salvador for siding with the poor people, and priests and nuns and others are being shot dead all over Central and South America for going against the powers that be.
Okay, now we're going to be talking about that again some more in the next broadcast of Radio Free America, which we're going to talk specifically about the Galen organization, okay? Returning again to Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America. As a bishop and a fierce anti-communist who had fled his native land supposedly to escape red oppression, Trifa moved in influential circles throughout Cold War America. He made broadcasts over Radio Free Europe to Romania, broadcasts he bragged were arranged, quote, "by my good friend J. Edgar Hoover," unquote. He sat on daises with the governor of Michigan, and his picture appeared in newspapers shaking hands with a smiling Hubert Humphrey. On Wednesday, May 11th,